The White House says Russia kills its own soldiers who don't follow orders.
We also have information that Russian commanders are threatening to execute entire units if they seek to retreat from Ukrainian artillery fire.
Plus, while the future of U.S. congressional approval of aid for Ukraine remains in limbo, EU leaders express broad support.
If we don't help Ukraine, then what is the alternative? Russia wins. And so what happens next? Why do you think that you're safe then when we give away Ukraine and don't support them right now?
And later in the program, concerns grow by the day for a Ukrainian journalist who has been missing for 3 months now. Today is Friday, October 27th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. The White House says Russia isn't just killing Ukrainian civilians and soldiers, but it's also killing its own troops who don't comply. National Security Spokesman John Kirby.
Some of them on the orders of their own leaders. We have information that the Russian military has been actually executing soldiers who refuse to follow orders. We also have information that Russian commanders are threatening to execute entire units if they seek to retreat from Ukrainian artillery fire.
During a news conference Thursday, Kirby called the actions barbaric.
But I think it's a symptom of how poorly Russia's military leaders know they're doing and how bad they have handled this. From a military perspective.
He said it appears the Russian military is using what he described as human wave tactics.
Just throwing masses of these poorly trained soldiers right into the fight. No proper equipment, no leadership, no resourcing.
And while Kirby didn't provide any details on how many Russian soldiers have been executed, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara followed up with Kirby on the report and asked about Ukraine's upcoming peace talks.
You said that Russia is executing soldiers who refuse to follow orders. What is the basis of this information and why are you sharing it now?
It is based on information that we have received we believe that as they try to continue to conduct offensive operations, it was important to make that public, to showcase for the world how desperate they're becoming.
And next week, Malta will be hosting the third Ukraine Peace Formula Summit. Who's representing the U.S., and does the administration believe that President Zelensky's peace plan is gaining more support?
We believe his peace formula is important, and we're doing everything we can to help actualize it and operationalize it. I don't have an agenda or participation list to speak to right now about the meeting in Malta, but we fully support the efforts of Ukraine to continue to work with the international community to again, move that peace formula forward. It is vitally important to us that whatever peace looks like in Ukraine, that it's acceptable to President Zelensky and the Ukrainian people, and that has to start with his peace formula.
The release of the U.S. intelligence on Russia's actions towards its noncompliant soldiers comes as President Biden is pressing the Republican-led House for more funding for Ukraine. Newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson is against sending money to Ukraine without conditions, while noting Israel as a priority.
The first bill that I'm going to bring to this floor in just a little while will be in support of our dear friend Israel, and we're overdue in getting that done.
Biden met with Johnson and Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries at the White House Thursday to discuss his request for nearly $106 billion for Israel, Ukraine, and other national security needs. Johnson, a staunch conservative allied with Donald Trump, has shown little interest in providing additional money from Congress to support Ukraine in its war against Russia. But later, he did insist Congress is not going to abandon Ukraine, while asserting it needs more information about the Biden administration's Ukraine strategy. At the EU summit this week in Brussels, leaders expressed their broad support on a plan for $50 billion in aid for Ukraine over the next 4 years. Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas.
If we don't help Ukraine, then what is the alternative? Russia wins. And so what happens next? Why do you think that you're safe then when we give away Ukraine and don't support them right now? So that is a question that is actually unanswered by them. So I think we have to talk further.
While neither rejected the proposal outright, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban on Thursday said he wanted the proposal for the $53 billion to be better justified before he could agree to it, and his Slovakian counterpart cited corruption in Ukraine while also expressing his reservations. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar pushed back on those concerns.
I expect we will disagree on this matter. We have a very strong view that Ukraine has a right to defend its sovereignty, its independence, its democracy. It's by no means a perfect country, and there are and have been issues and problems around corruption, for example. But this is a war of aggression. Russia has invaded, an unprovoked invasion, is trying to take over all or part of that country. If we don't stop Putin in Ukraine, he won't stop there. So it is a threat to all of us.
The EU's overall support for Ukraine totals almost $85 billion since Russia invaded in February of 2022. President Volodymyr Zelensky this week claimed that recent Ukrainian attacks have denied the Russian fleet safe bases and secure maritime corridors in the western part of the Black Sea, as Kyiv's troops look to squeeze the Kremlin's occupying forces out of the Crimean Peninsula. For insights on this strong statement, I spoke with Taya Dunleavy, senior analyst with the Center for Maritime Strategy. President Zelensky has recently, just this past week, said that Russian naval fleets are no longer safe in the Black Sea near Crimea. That is a bold statement. What do you see the reasoning for him saying that? Are they really a threat now to the Russian fleet?
It is definitely a bold statement. And he also mentioned that there is this illusion of the Black Sea fleet that's been shattered by Ukraine's recent naval developments. And Ukraine's recent naval developments can be considered successes. Within the broader counteroffensive of Ukraine that's been ongoing, but now is extended to the maritime domain. This is important because early in the war, honestly, the maritime domain was not a large part of the conversation. It was mostly discounted. We pretty much assumed that Russia and its Black Sea fleet maintained de facto control of the Black Sea and was able to shape the region according to Russia's interest because of its military and naval strength and presence in the Black Sea. It effectively blockaded the Ukrainian coastline, bombarded Ukrainian coastal cities, and effectively had the upper hand for the better part of a year.
Right.
Now we're seeing tides are turning exactly as Zelensky said. And I think what he's saying is very accurate. We can see that by the measurement that Russia is moving its Black Sea fleet from Sevastopol on Crimea, now putting it into a quote-unquote safer place in Novorossiysk, on the eastern side of the Black Sea. We also see that the Russian Navy and the Black Sea fleet is looking to consolidate more power there rather than put more forces closer to Ukraine in Crimea and Sevastopol. So there's been recent announcements that the Russian Navy plans to establish a naval base in Abkhazia in Georgia, which is really significant as well because Abkhazia's disputed territory back to the 2008 Russian invasion of Georgia. Georgia's upset about this establishment, but that's kind of a side point. All to say that Russia is putting long-term, it's investing long-term in the eastern part of the Black Sea rather than consolidating more forces in the western part of the Black Sea, which is all to say that Ukraine is gaining more and more control over its own waters.
How was it able to do that?
There were many different tactics that Ukraine was able to use. And Ukraine is not the only factor here. We also can look at the role of Western-supplied weapons, for example. Anti-ship missiles like Harpoons, Neptunes, which were important for the sinking of the Russian Black Sea flagship ship, the Moskva. Those played an important role. But we also see the role of rapidly developing Ukrainian naval technology, especially when it comes to drones. So, for example, the kamikaze drone within the past couple of months that was able to attack Russian ships docked at Novorossiysk demonstrates the longer range capabilities of the Ukrainian Navy through these new unmanned and technologically advanced systems. So it's not necessarily a classic naval battle in the Black Sea, where it's surface vessel against a surface vessel. It's these unmanned, small kamikaze drones that are able to inflict significant damage to Russia's Black Sea fleet. So those are a couple of the important factors that have led to Ukraine's success.
And of course, we know since the Russian blockade, there has been an alternative Black Sea export corridor. We've been hearing some conflicting reports this past week. A non-Ukrainian source, I believe it was a shipping company, was saying that that alternative corridor was closed now, that it wasn't safe. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is disputing that, saying it is still functioning and open for business. What are you hearing about all that?
So what I'm able to see just from open source reporting is that the Ukrainian government is adamantly stating that the humanitarian corridor is up and running. Even if that is true, that doesn't mean that there's not substantial threats to the humanitarian corridor. It may be true that the Ukrainian Navy is still able to maintain the sea lanes that have been protected by the corridor. But at the same time, we know that Russia has threatened to lay down more mines closer to the corridor. We know that Russia has harassed commercial vessels for landed several Russian military officers on a commercial vessel just a couple months ago in order to intimidate vessels transporting to Ukraine. So those threats are persistent. But in this most recent case, what I saw is that there was some ordnance, some explosive ordnance, and concerns about that, particularly close to the sea lanes. And this also involved Russian air power, as far as I understand. So this kind of demonstrates that, you know, although we can say Ukraine is shattering the illusion of the Black Sea Fleet, Russia's not giving up yet. We know that Crimea is extremely important to Russia for historical reasons, symbolic reasons, military reasons, geopolitical. The list goes on and on and on. And although they may be withdrawing vessels from Sevastopol, that doesn't mean that, you know, Crimea is still not what's often called the floating Russian aircraft carrier. It doesn't mean that it's still not going to be a base or contribute to other operations that threaten shipping from Ukraine and also just provide other types of military threats to Ukraine as well.
But are shipping companies going to feel safe enough to actually want to move through there? Are companies going to be willing to risk that?
It's a really important question that changes hour by hour and day by day. We know that insurance premiums for shipping, they change every few days and they evolve as the situation develops in the Black Sea. So Russia's ongoing threats to shipping, a few of the examples we just talked about, you know, for example, harassing commercial vessels going to and from Ukraine, threatening to lay mines, threatening to sail warships or sail naval vessels closer to this shipping corridor. Those are all intimidating and bullying tactics that Russia is using in hopes to deter commercial shipping. But what I'd say is, despite these threats, as pervasive as they are, we've still seen over 50 ships that have been able to navigate through Ukraine's humanitarian corridor, which is not backed by the United Nations. It's not backed by Turkey. It's not backed by these other powers that protected the UN Grain Initiative pathway, for example. This is just Ukraine that's been able to provide enough assurance in order to facilitate exports from Ukraine. And so that's a developing story. I'm sure we'll see that Russia will continue to try and intimidate the commercial shipping industry through these threats in the Black Sea. Yet we're also seeing Ukraine do some really impressive maneuvering to allow for commercial exports.
Taya Dunleavy, senior analyst with the Center for Maritime Strategy, thank you so much. About 700,000 metric tons of grain have been exported through Ukraine's new Black Sea export corridor since it began operating in August, according to the Ukrainian agriculture minister. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. For many Ukrainians, the Israel-Hamas conflict is similar to the war Ukraine is fighting. Jewish community representatives and politicians in Ukraine hope the U.S. will continue to support both Israel and Ukraine as the world's attention turns away from Russia's full-scale invasion of their country to the escalating war in the Middle East. VOA Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze reports from Kyiv.
In this one of the oldest synagogues in the center of Kyiv, military chaplains from different faith came together for supper. At the dinner table, they discussed the challenges of war. Having been on the front line of the Russian-Ukrainian war since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, they see many parallels between their fight and the recent attack on Israel by Hamas militants. Rabbi David Millman explains the origin of the Israeli-Hamas conflict to his colleagues. He says he was shocked by the attack. First, Millman says he was horrified. His children are in Israel, his grandchildren are also there. He couldn't understand how this was possible. He and other didn't expect anything like this. They were expecting such attack from Hezbollah or Iran, but not Hamas. Compared to Hezbollah and Iran, he says, Hamas are pocket bandits or minor threats. Israeli intelligence did not pay enough attention to Hamas. As Millman sees it, the Russian assault on Ukraine and the Hamas attack on Israel followed the same playbook. He said Hamas could not have carried out this attack without serious help and planning from outside. He suspects Russia, although he says he has no evidence. Rabbi Millman shows us President Volodymyr Zelensky's chair together with the Israeli ambassador's chair in the front row of this synagogue. Millman has two homelands, Ukraine and Israel, and he feels both countries need support to combat aggression. Igor Samovolos, executive director at Ukraine's Association of Middle East Studies, says both wars involve the same enemies of democracy. Samovolos says that on a strategic level, there is no doubt that Russia and Iran are involved. And since both are enemies of democracies like that of Ukraine and Israel, it can only affect the conflict in Ukraine. He says the fight is becoming more global, and like U.S. President Joseph Biden says, it's part of the world confrontation between democracies and autocracies. He says that Ukrainians are feeling its effect. Ivana Klimpush-Sensadze, the chair of the Parliamentary Committee on Integration of Ukraine to the EU, says many Ukrainians see the attack on Israel as part of the same war that Ukraine is fighting. She supports President Biden's approach of combining an aid package for Ukraine and Israel.
As far as I understand, considering all the nuances of the American politics right now, internal politics, this is a very smart approach in explaining to American public what the American people should stand up against in supporting both Israel and Ukraine.
Ukraine has significance for many Jewish people. Past Israeli leaders Golda Meir and Ariel Sharon had roots in the country, and Millman says many Jewish religious figures are buried here. He says he prays daily for both lands to be supported in their fight for survival. Miroslava Gongadze, VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Well, despite bleak outlooks on their emotional and financial well-being, Ukrainians remain optimistic about their future, according to a Gallup poll released this week. The pressures of war have been weighing heavily on Ukrainian citizens since Russia's full-scale invasion. While many say they've been unable to afford necessities such as food and water, many others report experiencing difficult feelings, with worry high on the list. Russian forces have lost at least a brigade worth of troops trying to advance on Ukraine's eastern town of Avdiivka. Russia has been renewing its push to encircle the embattled town, trying to overwhelm Ukrainian positions with constant barrages of artillery and waves of troops and fighting vehicles. I got details from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Yes, so as we discussed already, situation is Avdiivka is kind of a central in terms of discussion right now of the Ukrainian front line. And President Zelensky just recently had a conversation with the Prime Minister of UK, Rishi Sunak, where he was also talking about Avdiivka and confirming that Ukrainian soldiers basically managed to stop the assault by Russian soldiers at this point, at least. And also he confirmed that Russian forces have significant losses in that area. Particularly, he said that at least a brigade of personnel was killed by Ukrainian soldiers, Russian personnel. So we understand that situation remains extremely tough, but there is certain success by the Ukrainian forces as well.
And what about the Kharkiv region?
Well, Kharkiv region, we see again the reports about intensifying of the shelling, and as we also discussed already about Kupiansk region, that it will be evacuation of families with children. Also, Izum region was under fire in these recent days, and in total, we can say that unfortunately, Kharkiv region again is suffering from more shelling and more victims of the shelling, and it looks like that at least 10 settlements in the Kharkiv region will be obliged to evacuate families with children.
And turning to something more technical, Anna, it sounds like Ukraine will start to increase production of ammunition. Tell us more about what you're hearing about that.
The Ukrainian Secretary of the National Security and Defense Council, Alexei Danilov, in his recent speech at the Ukrainian television marathon, he mentioned that basically Ukrainian is soon to increase the production of ammunition at the expense of state and private enterprises, and that the equipment has already been installed, at least certain equipment, as he said. He mentioned that this is the way for Ukraine, because of course Ukraine needs more, and as the war is ongoing and in some areas of the frontline fightings are intensifying, it's absolutely priority for Ukraine to not only get equipment as a support by the allies, but also to produce more of its own. And he said that, of course, the state cannot basically cover all of those, but private companies, Ukrainian private companies can help. And this is exactly what's happening. So more details might be coming sometime soon, but he said that this is what's basically happening right now. And it's already something special that he can tell, because definitely this is a top secret information and it will remain. So we will be waiting for possibly more updates on that.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much for the update.
Thank you.
Fears are growing for a Ukrainian journalist who has not been seen or heard from in months. Carmela Caruso has the story narrated by VOA's Jessica Jarit.
It's been almost 3 months since Ukrainian journalist Victoria Roshina went missing. The award-winning reporter had been traveling to Ukraine's southeast in August. She sent a message saying she had passed the checkpoint, then silence. Ukrainian security services later told Roshina's family she was captured by the Russians, says her friend Anna Nematova, who works for the Daily Beast.
Your parents are heartbroken. Your father, your mother, your sister, they're all very, very worried about her. And they regret that she wouldn't stop covering the most dangerous regions. But nobody could stop Victoria.
Roshina made a name for herself with fearless coverage when Russian forces invaded her home country. The freelance journalist pivoted from covering court cases to reporting on the front lines. In her first weeks, soldiers shot at her car and Russia's Federal Security Service detained the journalist for 10 days. She later described the experience for the Ukrainian news website Hromadske, saying, "I didn't feel fear. There was only despair over the unknown and wasted time, the inability to do my job." The journalist's coverage last year was recognized with a Courage Award from the International Women's Media Foundation, or IWMF. Here's Executive Director Elisa Liz-Munez.
The fact that she was detained by Russian soldiers and lived through that experience and went back and kept reporting as if that never happened certainly shows an incredible amount of courage and tenacity, and a journalist who's willing to risk everything to report the news.
1 year later, Munez and others are advocating for Roshina's release. This time, though, it's been nearly 3 months since anyone has received word. As friends and former colleagues wait for news, they reflect on Roshina's bravery. Ukrainian journalist and activist Maria Romanenko worked alongside Roshina for several years. She describes her as a quiet, hardworking woman with fierce courage and a tireless commitment to do her job as a journalist.
It's just this sort of like very, very impressive braveness in her, and always going for those stories that nobody else, I think, really wanted to. And she did it willingly, like, you know, she would volunteer to do these things. And that always really, really impressed me.
She, like Munez and Nemstova, are all hoping for Roshina's safe return. They say sharing her story is one way to be sure she is not forgotten. For Carmela Caruso, Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
And that will do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.